You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hello there and welcome to the show. This is another new episode, a fresh interview, someone who's never been on the show before. It's the wonderful, well, the honourable Tom Horton. And we are going to get into loads of stuff, not least the fact that for a long time he lived in the Tower of London, because he is quite literally the honourable Tom Horton in a way that, I mean, even English people find hard to believe, let alone people further afield than here. It must be quite peculiar. We're going to talk a little bit about his title. And we're going to talk about his life. We're going to talk about his really ballistic comedy style. He is a really roof-raising comic, and he's also quite the influencer. Not only does he have a huge amount of followers across your various social platforms, particularly TikTok, as we'll discuss in some length, but he is also, he was until recently, on a Netflix influencer slash reality show. That's what I've written. That sort of sounds vaguely right. Called The Circle, and we're going to talk at some length about his involvement with that show and how he stopped from going mad and whether that worked. We'll also talk about his background in improv with the really fun improv group The Noise Next Door, and we're going to uncover in true ComCom style his lifelong quest to master sincerity in his work. Now, this is a big long one, and I wish, as I often do, as I was looking down the log of this episode, kindly done by Chief Logger Moz, lots of love to Moz, I was looking down the log and thinking, I just want to put it all in the main ep, but we talked for so long I could not, so there are at least 25 minutes of extras available to you if you are a member of the Insiders Club, and if you're not, you can join up now at comedianscomedian.com/insiders to get ad-free episodes, extra content from every show that has it, and much more, some special exclusive Q&As with Nish Kumar, Alfie Brown, James Acaster and Fern Brady, and all that kind of stuff. In the extras of this episode, we'll be exploring the relationship between Tom's posh guy positioning and his most authentic comedy self, how he was called out by some very non-toxic male friends on his more obnoxious behaviour, and we will also get some further and some very excellent tips on social media mindset and the work ethic therein. Loads of great stuff here. Really a pleasure to have Tom on the show. Here is the Honourable Tom. So, welcome Tom Horton to the podcast. It's lovely to have you on, finally. You have got a huge amount of stuff. I often write kind of notes for questions, but with you I've just got subject headings because there's just so many things that we can talk about.
Oh, thank you.
Before we get into them, the sort of, should I try and loosely sketch where I think you are as a comic, or would you like to? We set you up for people who might not know.
I'm going to be honest to you. I want to see what you think of me. I want to hear what your opinion is.
Of course you do. As soon as I said that, I was like, who could turn that down?
Yeah,
well,
absolutely.
I think you're a big loser.
Yeah. Oh, he's nailed me. He's nailed me in one.
So we first met when you were in improv outfit, The Noise Next Door.
Indeed, yes.
And you bravely left The Noise Next Door and struck out on your own as a stand-up.
We'll get into that perhaps.
But you still retain what I think of as the key USB of The Noise Next Door, which is you're all massive board game nerds. So we'll maybe talk about that as well.
I am absolutely a board game nerd, yep.
You then, having struck out bravely on your own, you you sort of knew comedy from, you knew loads of comics, so you weren't like a new stand-up for very long. You knew loads of people, you threw yourself into it. Of course, you've got an improv background, so your crowd work's fantastic, you riff and all the rest of it, but you also lent into writing proper jokes. You then leveraged the fact that you are incredibly fucking posh, and rather than run away from it, you have lent into it to the extent that you have enjoyed a kind of, I won't say late, but a more recent social media bloom, whereby over the course of the pandemic, you were in where you live, which is the Tower of, or which is or was the Tower of London.
I've moved out now. The dream's over. I now live in the less fancy Borough Market, but still not bad.
I was really hoping you'd say I now live in Tower Bridge.
Yeah. I live in Hampton Court.
So you did that, and then you great big social media explosion. You now have like 300,000 followers on TikTok, and you have really applied yourself to TikTok and Reels and those kind of things. We'll get into all of that.
Yes.
But the point at which I would like to start, and obviously tour, stand-up, comedy circuit, blah, blah, blah. The point at which I would like to start is hashtag ToodlePip.
Oh, God. So you've watched The Circle, have you?
No. I watched as little of it as I possibly could.
I was going to say, that is not the show for you, Stu. That is not the show for anyone.
It's not aimed at me. And I can watch stuff like that. I can skim through that on Netflix, blissfully thinking this is mercifully not aimed at me.
Yes.
Is it aimed at you? Are you the sort of person it's aimed at? Tell us about your experience there.
I certainly think it's aimed at people like me's girlfriends and people like me sitting next to them on the couch and go, yeah, no, he maybe he is a catfish. Yeah, no, sure. Oh, yeah, no. Talisa was conniving, wasn't she? It was quite a
Describe the premise for us, please.
So I've got this into a pretty good soundbite now because Netflix of media strained me. But basically, The Circle is a reality TV show where a variety of strangers are handpicked and stuck into separate hotel rooms and isolated from each other, so they never get to meet each other. The only way they can interact is through a bespoke social media site called The Circle, which is essentially like a Facebook. And it's a popularity.
Did we have it in the UK? Am I being an idiot here? It's an American show, but there was a UK version, was there?
So it was originally a Channel 4 version and it was filmed in England. Okay. And then I was actually... That was the show I thought I was going to be on, the Channel 4 one. And I think a bunch of other comics might have been as well. And then suddenly, I think I saw a comic post going, oh, they've cancelled The Circle on Channel 4. That's a shame. I was in the running to be on that. And I was like, that's interesting. I haven't heard from it. And then I got a phone call going, would you like to be in the Netflix version? And I went, that is better. Yes, I would like that very much, please.
Yes.
But then I thought, oh, my God, it's the American version. I'm going to go to L.A. This is incredible over there. But it turns out it's cheaper for them to keep the same hotel and fly the contestants over rather than build a new hotel. So I went to Salford.
Oh, I thought you were going to say it was cheaper simply to be in everyone's local hotel and it all takes place online.
Oh, yeah. Well, but you do meet each other sort of when you get blocked and everything. But so the twist of the show is that... as you're interacting over this bespoke social media site, it's a popularity contest. So you vote each other, you rank each other internally, and whoever the top people are become influencers and then are able to block anyone from below. And gradually, one after the other, you get picked up until the final person wins £100,000. The twist is that you don't have to play yourself on the social media site. You can be a catfish, you can lie. So... for example, my whole storyline is my biggest ally is a 51-year-old cougar from Georgia who I was sourcing up the entire series until at the end it turns out it was two 25-year-olds playing a 51-year-old woman. And I got completely dragged along, completely fooled.
Okay. How – and your time in that show is now concluded?
I filmed it over a year ago.
Jesus, but it's just come out and you've just been booted.
It's just been released on Netflix. They filmed season 4 and 5 back to back, but then mine was meant to be season 4, but they swapped mine with season 5 because two of the Spice Girls were in the other season, and they contractually said we want our season out first, and so they're the Spice Girls, and sure. And they went sure. So they went first. But actually, it's better for me because firstly, it's January, so it's a time where rather than the summer, people watch more TV and binge now more, and also my tour starts now, so. Mm-hmm. That's beneficial. Also, it gave me enough time to now write bits of The Circle into my upcoming tour. So now I can go, did you like me on The Circle? Come and hear me talk about it on my tour. So it's actually worked out very well for me.
So am I right in thinking, like, I mean, the listener will not hear this, but I had my face in my hands for a lot of that. The, specifically, I think when you mentioned the social voting and the, you know, all the rest of it, it is my idea of hell.
Yeah.
How did you approach it? Do you, is it okay, here's the question. Going into it, my assumption would be that you, a smart cookie with you know, things to promote, like you're not a, you're not a sort of nebulous influencer, you're not even a sort of, I mean, you are a TikToker, but you're a comic first and foremost. Mm-hmm. And so TikTok is sort of, I think, a lot of us regarded as a necessary evil. Maybe it's regarded as a necessary evil by those of us who are less kind of influential on it because of that thing. I want to talk about that. I would regard doing a show like that as an absolute deal with the devil. And I wonder whether you, how did you apprehend it in those ways? Because obviously you've got units to shift, right? You've got to sell tour tickets, you've got to get out there. And I guess to my mind, it is a similar sort of deal with the devil to generating loads and loads of material on TikTok. You said yourself, as we were setting up the mics for this recording, God, this is the job of a comedian now, is to know the difference between Logic Pro and Audacity and QuickTime.
Really is,
and
which,
you know. So talk to me about the deal with the devil. My words, not yours, as it references The Circle.
Yeah, no. Well, I think a deal with the devil is sort of accurate in many ways. I think it's the one of the problems at the moment that I think lots of young comedians starting out have is it's a very oversaturated game now. It's so many people vying for your spot, for your chance. So exposure is one of the biggest things. So personally, I sort of felt, look, you've been given this chance and you're only going to get so many chances, Tom. You've got to go with this. And I think there was a stage, maybe even just 10 years ago, where I think reality TV shows would have looked at by comedians going, you wouldn't do that if you're a real comic. No real comic would go do that.
That's when I did one back then. That's how I felt about it.
So you think the fun? Show me the funny.
I did show me the funny.
Show me the funny, yes. But you know, now we've got Sean Walsh eating slugs in the jungle, and we've got all sorts of people doing whatever. I think nowadays, I think the view, I believe, has shifted as far as comedians going on these types of shows. I think people understand now that you have to play the game. And there's only so many ways you can shine. So I was worried about it. I think The Circle is a type of show that it's a fun game rather than something like Love Island, which is like, I don't, for me, there was a difference there because I felt like something like Love Island, where you're sort of relationships and you're trying to sort of artificially pretend you've got emotions towards people. There's something a bit grim about that. Whereas having said that, I have been on First Dates, but
oh, you have! I remember that.
I'm a reality TV star first now, and then a tech expert second, and then a comedian comes about seventh, I think. But The Circle to me was like a giant board game in a way, playing with your mates, because it's such a ridiculous concept and it's fun. So
okay. And I have to share with you, when you said that, I thought, nice angle. That's a good way to convince yourself it's the right thing.
Yeah.
I like board games. This is like a big board game, right? Right?
Yeah. Oh, and you should see me repeating that to myself in front of the mirror before, throughout the audition process. No, it's fine.
I'm going to roll a D20. If I get a critical one, I'll come on the show. Yeah.
There's also things, so I knew it was a good one to... That I could show my potential of being a comedian on. One thing about, I think, reality TV is a lot of reality TV players, people who go on it, are people who don't necessarily have anything to then sell at the end of it. They just need to then do like boohoo contracts or perfume stuff.
Boohoo is a clothing brand, I believe.
Yes,
fine. I'm just going to underline that for people like me who aren't entirely sure of the brand Boohoo. And actually, it sounds like an industry term. I don't know what it would be like. Oh, I've had to sign that. It's like the opposite of the rich and famous contract that Kermit signs. Oh, this is the Boohoo contract, sadly.
Yes, exactly. Whereas one thing about being a comedian is once you've done it, you've got Come and See Me on Tour. You've got a literal thing you can then sell. So it actually is beneficial. And so I was very adamant that I was going to play myself on there rather than a catfish or pretend to be anyone else.
Yes. Yes, of course. Yeah.
I could have been someone else. And I was very much like, no, I'm going on as definitely me. The only lie I made is at the time I was in a relationship. And so I pretended to be single. Because at the time, The Crown was on Netflix and Harry and Meghan had just gone off to America. And I was the Honourable Tom Horton living in the Tower of London, a historical palace. So I was like, in my profile, I was like, English chap looking for his Meghan Markle. And I thought that would be a good way to ingratiate myself with the US and indeed the other players. But do you know, it turned out on the show, actually, the other contestants, all the American contestants, when I said live in the Tower of London, none of them knew what the Tower of London was.
You sat thinking, are they going to buy this?
Yeah,
and they're like, no, that's just what they think London is a tower.
One of them went, is that where the waxworks are? Oh, God.
Yeah.
No.
Did you go stir crazy cooped up in a hotel room on your own? Was it that sort of a thing?
Oh, yes. So I had to have 2 weeks before I went on with a chaperone in Salford with only like 1 hour outside allowed. No, my phone wasn't allowed. And then when you go in, you are then 24-hour surveillance. You're in a hotel room, essentially. They are mic'd you up the entire time. You aren't allowed any music. You're not allowed any TV. You aren't allowed a watch or to know what the time is. So one of the things they do, and I was in there for the... spoiler alert. One thing is that the welfare team do is... as soon as you come out of the circle, the first question they go, here's a little game we always play, but what day do you think it is? And what time do you think it is? And there are contestants who have been out by days. I've got no idea what day it is. I think it's about 11 in the evening. And they're like, it's 5 in the morning and it's 2 days more than it. So you really
do
get...
What did you do for all that time?
So you're allowed books. Okay. And I went. I'm gonna read some classics because I'm gonna really catch up on the gaps in my knowledge. I read 1984, terrible decision for a book to be under 24 hours, really bad. I thought, oh, this would be really on brand with the whole thing, and no, it sent me stir.
The welfare
crazy.
Person really should have highlighted that.
yeah, they really should. They then allowed me a guitar, which was nice because then I then started making up improv songs about the cast members and stuff, which shows some more talent. I also was allowed to draw, so I caricatured all of the other contestants as well and stuck them on my wall. I was, in my desperate attempt to seem multi-talented, I was like, look at all the skills I've got, Netflix. And then they give you other stuff like jigsaw puzzles and things you can do. And a lot, when you are sort of a bit like lockdown, actually, and it just came after lockdown. Do you know how, in lockdown, suddenly I was making meals with, 17 ingredients and really stretching out the cooking. Like, you don't want a quick pizza. Make that stuff last. Really, really go. So you learn to stretch time.
Okay, God. And how do you feel now that you are out of it? Did it work? Have you got any data on whether or not, other than it was a good time, it was fun, have you got any, and I say data, I sort of mean it as a metaphor, but really, I mean actual data, thinking about it, because we now have insights on Reels and TikTok.
Yes.
Have you suddenly got a much bigger following in the States and that kind of thing? What have you seen that's concrete?
Well, so I think it's only been out for a couple of weeks, and also it gets released in four episode chunks. And most I've been told, most people wait until the entire series is released and then binge it all rather than do it incrementally. But my Instagram went up 15,000 followers,
Okay.
which is a lot.
Okay.
I've sold enough tickets. I've added 22 extra dates to my tour. So without
there
being,
we go.
We're still trying to stay humble. It has definitely made a difference. Yeah.
That's
fantastic. One of the things that I will say is it'll be interesting because, and I won't name any other names, but chatting to a comedian who had a similar social media boost. And then the people, the type of audience members that brings to your show. Because they're not necessarily audience members who have a great attention span. They're not necessarily very theatrically literate. They've never been to a comedy club or even the theatre before. They've just gone, oh, that guy that I've seen off that thing that I like. Or girl.
Oh, my God.
And so he said that a lot of the time he'd do his show and actually be big pockets of the audience who were just sort of like watching, not really laughing. And then afterwards they'd be like, it was the best thing I've ever seen. Can I have a selfie? And he realized that actually they were going not to watch the show, but just to say that they'd been there because they're doing it for their own. They're doing it for their own social media.
Oh, God, that's dystopian, isn't it?
Yes, it's quite alarming.
I mean, I do. I think you've just reminded me. I can't remember who I was talking to about this, but someone had said they'd really blown up on TikTok, but the TikTok audience skews so young that the fans don't have any money and they can't that you think, oh, I've got X thousand fans now across this particular platform. But what you've got is X thousand 13 and 14 year olds who can't engage with a lot of the things that you'd like to sell to
them. Yes, no, you've got a fan base of Chinese bots and infants.
So this is Tom, a joy to talk to him. Very, very, I mean, he's very candid, which we always love here. And also one of the things I think about Tom is he is someone who really willingly submitted to the process. Do you know what I mean? He's very, I mean, this is by no means one of the most painful processes to which he has ever submitted himself. Bless his heart. It's heartbreaking stuff about boarding school. My God. But he was really kind of willing to like, OK, come on, goldsmith me in a way that I really found very fun and engaging and charming. And I'm sure that you are, too. So we'll get back to this very soon. Remember, loads more stuff about positioning, authenticity, some obnoxious behaviour and how it got called out. And also some tips on social media, mindset and work ethic, all available on the Insiders feed. Go to comedianscomedian.com/insiders to support the show for just £2 a month or more and access all that stuff. You can catch Tom, by the way, on his sellout tour. He's currently, I'm pleased to say, this was recorded a few weeks ago now, but it is going great guns, and he's adding extra dates as we speak. He started doing that thing which all the clever kids are doing, which is to very artfully and deftly put sold out signs as if they've been pasted on top of your social media assets, such to emphasize how sold out the tour is. But there's extra dates added. You can go to honourabletom.com/pages/tour or just go to honourabletom.com and have a mosey around there. If you'd like to follow Tom on Twitter, Instagram or TikTok, I mean, you basically can't on TikTok because he's got so many followers, there may not be room for more. But go to @HonourableTom. And I do wonder now how many Americans he loses who try to follow Honourable Tom, but insist on skipping the U that word must always contain. So you can find out more about Tom via all those things. My stand-up special, I Need You Alive, is currently now available on video on demand and indeed audio on demand. Go to stuartgoldsmith.com, follow the little exciting clicky advert there, and there's a little yellow spinning advert at the top of the page on any page that I put it there myself. God, I love knowing how to work my own website. And that will take you to a sort of a menu of all the different places you can get hold of the show. And you can find all of my various comedy clips as well. I've got to tell you, I'm happy to stand, if not shoulder to shoulder, then at least shoulder to calf with Tom on this, because Instagram has been going absolutely mad. There's a clip of mine on there now with 10 million views. Views, schmooze, you might think, and you'd be right. But a million people have liked it. So at least that many people must have watched the film. I mean, it's only 25 seconds long or something, but that is acting as this unbelievable kind of follower magnet. I keep looking at it and thinking, well, it must be slowing down now, but I think I hit 50,000 follows what was that, Saturday? And that, and it's Monday now, and it's so I record this, and it's on 55 and a half. Look, easy come, easy go. I can't imagine they're going to stay there for long, let alone buy tickets to anything I do in the real world. But perhaps they'll buy a tea towel or join a mailing list or something. So you can follow me on Instagram and indeed TikTok at Stuart Goldsmith Comedy, or join the mailing list to stay friends forever at comedianscomedian.com. Right. That's all the plugging I need to do for now. Thanks if you've been coming along to the previews. I'll tell you more about them at the end. Let's get back to the Honourable Tom. That's so much fun to say.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
So this is becoming a theory of mine, and I'm really hoping it doesn't. I'm hoping it sounds like a sort of, if not positive, then kind of a morally neutral observation, which is that obviously it's a very exciting time where, hey, there are no gatekeepers. And then I had this thought, and I don't know if it's original or if I read it somewhere. I think I came up with it, that the algorithm is itself a gatekeeper.
I didn't know the word algorithm until about 3 years ago, and now I think I use it more in speech than the word mum. I really do. Yeah.
The algo is your mum.
So pathetic,
now.
It really is. We're slaves to the algorithm, aren't we? And everyone is obsessed with how do you get a video that hits the algorithm, that rides the wave. Oh, if you do 15 yeah. second videos, oh, but you need to have the clickbaity title at the start. Oh, if you do different camera edits quickly, that keeps the attention, if you rather than dwelling too long, and use this sound to overlay it. You don't do subtitles, mate. What do you mean you don't do subtitles? You've got to do subtitles. I remember what I would say is one of the best things I did in lockdown, when everyone was going, what do I do, what's a hobby of mine, bake banana bread, do jigsaws, I taught myself to edit. And I think in the current climate, as a performer, learning the skill of editing is sort of the equivalent of knowing the foreign language in the holiday destination that you're on. Like, I think learning to edit is a language now of the future. And I think any up and coming performer, you have to do content, and learning to self edit is just an absolute life hack. You've got to do it.
When you say you have to do content, you mean you have to be like content as opposed to material. You have to be putting stuff out. Content in a wider, could be material, could be,
oh, I,
could
I,
be
yes.
pieces to camera or whatever they're called.
Yeah, yeah. I mean online content. And sadly, one of the most horrendous things I think about content and the state of online comedy is sadly quantity overrules quality. And that's just a sad fact that we're living in. You are one of the biggest tricks to hacking into an algorithm and getting a following on something like TikTok is just get one joke and repeat it in a different way. Like, so basically the classic
you don't mean literally one joke, like one
like
piece
premise,
of material
premise,
type joke.
I mean,
one
premise. So yeah. Like posh guy acts out films, and I go, oh, hello, I'm doing Titanic today. The next one, hello, this is Braveheart. And okay, this is yeah. Forrest Gump. And just do that, and you'll get a following. Just do that every single day. And that's, it's sad because it's sort of killing, you know, variety and nuance and people pushing boundaries and all this. But
it's almost like, although it does have all of those negative connotations, I feel those very strongly, because there are billions of people using, there are billions of people creator, or at least hundreds of thousands, you know, millions of people creating content, then it's almost, is that it's it's like keys used to work because you'd or passwords rather, you'd have a password, it was difficult to guess your password, so your password was safe, presumably at some fictional point. I've not read a book about this, but then computers came along which could brute force every conceivable password. So let me just follow this analogy. I think I've got a good point here. So the whole way, so passwords have to develop and encryption has to develop.
Yes.
So even though the individual content creator is less creative than perhaps at some point someone writing hours and hours of stand-up, there are many more of them. So the I wonder
if there is more variety, but just not.
Well, I wonder if there is.
No,
exactly.
Yeah, I think that is inevitable. Yeah, I can see that very much true. And also, I would point out, because you get a lot of the idea of gatekeepers of comedy, the idea that there's always been a thing about the working class never being able to get through to the industry bubble because of, you know, they aren't the right accent, they don't live in London, they haven't got enough money to take the risk of doing, you know, that sort of thing. Whereas now the internet has provided everyone with a chance because everyone with a phone in their hand has got a studio and they can do what they want. So it has become more accessible for anyone to now become a comedian or a entertainer of any way.
So that is a big bonus. How do you feel about that? How does that impact upon your expectations and dreams and what you want of your relationship with comedy?
Well, I never want to lose live comedy because that's the reason I think we all love comedy. You know, I like being in the room and I like feeling that energy. I like doing shows which are an hour long and have, you know, a journey. I try very hard not to follow or pay too much attention to what other people are doing online. I find if you keep on comparing yourself, it's a slippery slope of just going mad in your own head, going, oh, they've done that, but they've done that, or they've got that thing. Just try and stick in your lane and figure out what you want to do. Because there are also, there are lots of content creators I know who have got, you know, 250,000 followers, but then they can't actually hold a room on stage because obviously it's very different being funny for 15 seconds online in a recorded video to then doing 20 minutes to a live audience. But a lot of them don't want to do that, and that's fine. But
a lot of them have never been bitten by that bug. And a lot of them, even if you did say, hey, you could do this, they'd say, I've got to drive how far?
I've
got to travel how many days? How many nights have I got to be away?
Exactly. Whereas I don't know, I feel like I've just sort of, I've been a comedian for 16 years now. I feel like it's sort of just traveling and all that feels like home in a weird way. It just sort of, it's beaten into me.
I was going to say, traveling feels like home. I couldn't tell whether that was a positive thing or a harrowing thing. And then you qualify by saying it's been beaten into me, which suggests excuse.
Oh, yeah, it's domestic. In one There's way. A lot of domestic abuse at my house.
Tell me about your origins then. Pre-Noise Next Door. Tell me about your young Tom. And you went
very
to
young Tom.
You must spend a lot of time talking about boarding school because it does make you such an anomaly within the world of comedy, I think. It's so unusual, and I don't want to dredge through the stuff you've said on 100 other podcasts.
No, that's fine.
I went to a school which had, I went to a private school, and as I always have to say, I got a scholarship. I got a scholarship. We weren't super rich. I got a scholarship. There were boarders there. I wasn't one of them. There were boarders, and I don't remember I don't remember much of my childhood, but I don't remember them being, I have this vague sense that they were a bit weird. And I suppose now I've got a much clearer sense, now that I'm a dad, the concept of sending my child away, one of my children away to a boarding school is just anathema to my, I don't know what.
How old are your
parents here.
Your kids now?
My son turns 7 very soon, which is will be painful for anyone who remembers me talking about getting pregnant for the first time. He's a fan of the show. The Boutros is 7.
So I went to full boarding at 6 years old.
I mean, I'm not going to use the word child abuse, but I have. But I cannot imagine what that does to a child. And yeah. I can't imagine. I mean, listen, I know your dad was presumably quite busy being the head of the British Army, but
military.
I'm privileged to not be so busy. Sorry, say again.
British military, not just the
military.
Army.
Military.
the entire thing, please.
I beg your pardon. I'm so sorry. I'm insulting. But
that is the point, though. So because going through the army to then get where you want to be, we moved around all the time. So we moved house every year or two. So it was either go to boarding school or change school every year or two. So they picked
or dad does something different so he can have a relationship with his kid.
Sure. And then Russia attacks. And where are we?
Well, there are other soldiers. Wouldn't you be in touch? I mean, I'm talking speculatively. Your dad seems absolutely lovely from what I've seen of him on your TikTok. But did that not occur to you? Did that thought never? Or we could not. You could not do either, and we could be.
No.
Or is it just so young?
I grew up, and my dad's career was very much my family. My dad's career trajectory was always that was non-negotiable. But also, I'm a child, so I wouldn't have ever gone. I wouldn't have questioned my parents, especially not at 6 years old.
Would you not have said, please don't send me to boarding school? Well, or do you remember any of those feelings?
Oh, yeah. So I didn't really... You don't understand what boarding school means because you're six. So you're like...
God, Tom, I'm sorry. I'm having quite a big emotional reaction to this.
Well,
I'm sorry.
I'll tell you how brutal this is then. So I had been taken to an open day at the boarding school. Just to give a taster, and that being I've been dropped off on the day by my mum, seen all the people, all the kids who are, because there were some kids who were boarding since like four or five, whose parents lived in India and stuff. There's a story I know of one boarder who he got sent away at four and had to spend the entire year at boarding school, and then he got shipped back to India and his parents picked him up and he didn't recognise his parents when he arrived back home. So I've been to the open day. Then my parents clip me at the end to take me home. So then when it comes to the actual first day of properly starting boarding, and you know that first day is coming because you can hear the sewing machine with all the labels in your clothes going. Okay. You got given your locker number. Suddenly I got taken there. My mum dropped me off and said goodbye. And the headmaster goes, we find it's best if you just leave. Otherwise it gets emotional. So my mum did, and because she just left, because I'd been to the open day, in my head, I thought she's going to come and collect me at the end of the day. Oh. So at the end of my first day, all the boarders went off to the boarding houses, and I went with the day kids to the front school gates and stood there, and gradually, one after the other, they all got taken away. And so I was just left there standing on my own. And it took like an hour or two for a teacher to then find me and going, what are you doing here? That I'm waiting for my mum. No, she's not coming. And they had to bring me back in. And then you have that was a pretty, what do you mean she's not coming? That was pretty brutal. And then the first night, because you are in with a bunch of other sort of six-year-olds who are all missing their parents, you've all got the waterproof sheets on your bed, because obviously lots of kids at six, like, wet themselves in the first couple of nights. There's lots of crying. And I remember a very, very, very tangible, poignant feeling of suddenly the world felt big and cold. Yeah. And suddenly my bed was by the window, and I remember looking out and seeing the moon. And just, I remember very much thinking the sky's huge and outside's big, and it's all the world. Yeah, I felt very lonely, very alone, and very small in a very big place because it's the first time I'd ever not been at home. And in a strange place with strange people. Yeah, it was. But then I think you realize pretty quickly that all kids at that age are not enjoying it. And then if you cry, you remind the other kids that they're also sad. So there's a big thing about don't cry, because we all know what's going on. So don't let it be obvious. Just shut up and get on with it. So you learn to bottle it. And then I was reading a book by Nigel Duffel called The Making of Them, because that's what they say about boarding school, it'll be the making of you. And there's a syndrome called boarding school syndrome, and the way it manifests inside a kid is there's a contradiction in the kid's brain, because you go, I love my parents, they're the best thing ever, and they've told me this school is incredible and the best thing for me, but I don't like the school, But I know my parents are never wrong, so they can't be wrong, so I must be wrong. And that's how you manifest it. If I am not enjoying it, any of these negative emotions I'm feeling must mean there's something wrong with me. And then that quite often breaks a lot of kids. And I don't want to say that every person has a terrible time at boarding school and that I had some really nice memories, but there are, I think there is a fundamentally quite damaging aspect to the whole thing, especially at six.
And have you had that conversation with your folks?
I did a whole show about it called Class Dismissed, because I'm a comedian and what we do is put on a show. I did. And look, my mum was devastated. She cried. Like, when she drove away, she told me she used to drive down the school driveway and then round the corner outside, then park up and just burst into tears. But like I said, it was military. So I understand why they did it. There are lots of parents who send their kids to boarding school, though, or private school, because they want, you know. Oh, I was actually talking to Shappy Corsandi, who she said that she was like looking around a private school. And one of the parents came up and she went, hello, my name's Sasha, SW1, and introduced herself with her postcode. And so sending the Lord. Kids to the school is more of a bragging rights amongst the parents than anything else. And those people do exist, but my parents did it for legitimate reasons. So I understand.
Yes. Yes. Okay. I suppose, Jesus, Tom, I still regard my own schooling as brutal and dehumanizing. And I got to go to home every day.
Yeah.
And bitch about it, you know?
Yeah, I am. Well, also, so I was all boys. I was all boys as well, which is obviously very damaging, because especially at senior school when you're then, you know, testosterone's flying around and you can't really ever interact with women or girls, so you don't ever see them as people really. What happens is every Saturday after the rugby match, they stick you in a bus and they drive you 2 hours away to a neighbouring girls' school and stick you all in a sports hall for a social, essentially like a prize, right? You've done the sports match. Now here's your prize. Go and look at these women.
Oh, God.
And then you get taken away and that's your only interaction. So it's not surprising. So many of my friends were very horrendous when it came to talking with women or sort of seeing them as anything. My school also then, when I was 17, school of 600 boys, my year was the first year in its history to go co-ed. And they let 22 girls join in a school of 600.
Bloody hell. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's bring it back.
I've said a lot. Sorry.
No, not at all. No, I'm fascinated. I've never had that conversation with you before, and nor has that come up on the show. I'm fascinated by it, but I'm wondering about the kind of the crucible of you and your desire to not follow your dad into the army, which was presumably on the table or on offer or expected or desired. Who knows?
It's definitely a thing that kids of army officers just follow their father's footsteps. I mean, I was performing Cats the Musical on the stairs at 5 years old. So they thought maybe not the front line for this one.
Maybe something with camouflage.
Yeah. So I always had a performer in me. Also, that when it got to my stage, my dad was the head of the military. It's that he's completed the game. I'm already going to have a sort of time getting out of his shadow anyway.
Yeah, unless you can be king, then that's it. That's the only step up. Right?
Exactly right. Well, it's one of my jokes with my dad's the head of the military and I'm a clown in more than one way, big shoes to fill.
Yes, lovely.
Thank you very much. but also, so I think what also having a dad who's been, because my dad was the son of a shopkeeper as well, who got a scholarship into private school, who then he's an amazing man. He is a one-off, and he's, you know, he's a mind of the times, and he's incredible. I spent a lot of time sort of resenting that a bit, and now I've just learned that how lucky am I to have this guy as my dad, and it's brilliant. And actually living in the Tower of London with him really was really great at connecting again. We'll get back to that, I'm sure. But living up to him and trying to seek validation, all that sort of stuff, I did struggle with. I think the reason I became a comedian, one, boarding school, sort of learning to, being bullied at boarding school, I used jokes as a defense mechanism.
Okay.
Also, I think with moving...
It's a classic comics origin, but I think it's sort of particularly distant in your example.
Exactly. But then the other thing...
Where did you get the idea? Do you remember the beginnings of that? Do you remember a moment? Do you remember a kind of light switching on? Or had you read it? Because what you've described is such a kind of Roald Dahl story of a childhood up until that point, your mum driving away, you going to the gate to be picked up. Was there a moment, or did you kind of hear from any stories or media of any sort that kind of like, oh, one of the things I can do to avoid getting bullied is to be funny? Or did you invent it for yourself?
Well, I think in my prep school, I actually had a reasonably good... The bullying hadn't started in the sort of the younger up to 12. And I had a best friend of mine who, weirdly, he joined the army. And even though he used to get the main roles at school in the plays, him and me would do loads of fun stuff as well. And that... I enjoyed just being funny then, and I realized I was funny. Then at my senior school, when I got really severely bullied, badly. And the thing about being bullied at a boarding school is you can't leave the school. It's 24/7. And this isn't the time of FaceTime and iPhones. Like, I had to have coin operated 20p's to ring your parents and then they ring you back. Bad board, you know, like physically, you know, outstretched coat hangers being whipped and stuff and all this sort of thing, bad. And I remember chatting with this mate who then had joined me at senior school, walking to school, and me going, everyone hates me, and I don't know what I can do. I don't know what I can do. And he went, you're really funny. Be funny. And that really sticks to me in my mind. And I started being funny, and it got better. And so I've used that as my main tactic since. And it's taken me a long time to be... learn to be sincere again, if I'm being honest. And girlfriends have commented on it. I've had lots of problems with that and relationships. The other thing I would say about a military background and my parents, because I moved house every 1 or 2 years, that basically means at home you have to drop your friends and start again. Stop, start again. Is essentially next gig, next gig, next gig, walking in and making friends quickly before you have to drop them again. So I think that sort of skill of walking into a room and quickly being approachable and getting people to like you is another thing that led to... It was all going that way.
Yes, great skill set. Healthy, question mark? I mean, it does
definitely
seem
not.
Like... as we know from the comics, we know, as I know from all these interviews, the idea of perpetually being the person that kind of parachutes in and makes everyone like them and then disappears, kind of carried out shoulder high, and then you're on your own again.
Yes,
that is enormously enjoyable and also helps one not to solve any of one's problems, because it's like a quick fix night after night after night after night.
It
doesn't make you any like some other quick fixes we could think of. Unlike some other quick fixes we could think of, it doesn't make you ill or poor. In fact, the opposite. You can get rewarded in every sense imaginable for that kind of quick fix. I'm interested particularly in what you said about having to relearn sincerity or having to learn sincerity, because presumably if you like this, so this is the paradigm through which I'd see it is, I remember at school like really absolutely hated it. There's a photo of me in it, and it's overexposed because I'm standing in front of a window inside a house and I'm wearing my school uniform and I look miserable and I'm in near darkness against the outside world. And I just think of like, oh god, that was my school days. But when I was 11, I started going to a drama club at the weekends, and there were girls there and people laughed at me and it was fun. And I've had to unpick and unpack a lot of that stuff to realise 20 and 30 years later, oh, it does something to me when I make people laugh. Mm-hmm. It makes me feel whole. It transforms the scared little boy in the picture into a kind of superhero. He gets a Shazam moment of going, oh, I've accessed the thing. Bang, now I'm the superhero, right? And recognizing, God, how much has that informed so many of my decisions? Mm-hmm. How much does it continue to inform decisions I make or don't make as mm-hmm. I become an increasingly old man?
Yeah.
And I'm still kind of, that thing is still going on. So talk to me about that. I mean, that is like
the opposite.
It seems to me like you've had that experience with the contrast turned all the way up. You will be physically beaten with wire coat hangers unless you can get to the gag in time.
Yeah.
Like, how does that saved you? And then it must wreck you, must it not?
Well, yeah, because then, like, I think I've found as I've gotten into the wider world and met more of a variety of people, and I certainly think one of the problems I think comedians quite often fall into is that their work colleagues are also their only mates, and then you just talk shop forever, and then you suddenly get this feeling that, no, the most important thing in life is being funny. And actually, the majority of people love humour, and humour is it's the lubrication that bonds us socially, and it's what we all want. But there are so many people out there who also, they want to have a serious conversation. They want to, I mean, this podcast is a good example of talking seriously about stuff and actually being open, rather than, this isn't just a you and me firing zingers at each other. We're actually having a conversation. And that's what the real value comes in. It's interesting, actually, on The Circle, I had a moment, episode 8, there's a savage questions round. And my question was, is there any more depth to you, or are you just jokes?
Well,
yeah. And I then opened up about it and said my school story. And, you know, I was teary-eyed doing it, and it was a vulnerable moment that I did. And then in the ratings, I was top influencer, bang, straight away. Which part of me, it looks very calculated, but
well, I was thinking, you moron, episode 8, but then the editor's done with you now. You don't need to stay in the show anymore.
And then I get blocked the next episode. No.
Yeah, of course.
But my point is I think that people appreciate hearing sincerity, seriousness, vulnerability, depth, and I think, you know, you ever had that insult, which, well, you're always on, aren't you? Always on, which there are lots of comments. He's like, they're always on, aren't they? And you get in a car share with them and you're like, fucking hell.
Can you be off for a bit?
Can you just be off? I think it took me a while to learn, and it took me a lot of girlfriends going, why can't you just talk to me seriously before I got it? But I've now learned to,
And in your stand-up, I very much enjoyed The Honourable, which is your most recent special, which is currently available for free on YouTube.
Thank you very
much. And it follows a really lovely, I mean, there's a great story element, there's loads of really, and that's one of the aspects of your work is you can talk about a thing that literally no one else has experienced. Like, your life is so unusual that you get afforded a lot of people are just like, I'm just quite happy to listen to this. I mean, I'm not, like, what I mean is,
what a lovely compliment, Stu. Thank you very much.
I'm not suggesting that you milk that. What I mean is, there are certain acts I can see whose voice or background or story is such that their baseline, even in the pauses, even in the gaps between the jokes, is like, oh, this is fascinating.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I don't think you rely on that. I don't think at all.
No, but
I think it's easy to watch, because you go, even when I'm not laughing, I'm considering a thing I've genuinely never thought about before.
Yeah, well, I'm not relying on it, but I definitely did realise it. And I think there are acts there who don't. Have you ever been chatting to an act and they went, oh, yeah, because obviously I grew up in a cult? And you're like, what?
Yeah.
What? They went, like, have you never talked about that? Like, no. You're a fucking moron then. Like obviously talk about that. That's amazing. Like, you've got it. Like, your USP is so... we're in the age of identity and who am I and what are you. You need to... If you've got a USP, like, do dwell on that. Like, otherwise...
When did you start doing that? Because I didn't know this about your background the first time we met, the first few times we worked together, it was with The Noise Next Door. You're one of five people. There's a lot going on.
No one knew.
And so why did you keep it secret? I mean, I think I can hazard a guess, but why did you keep it yourself private, let's say, rather than secret?
Not sure. I think maybe I didn't have the... Well, my dad hadn't fully got to the top of the military yet, and we hadn't moved to the Tower of London yet. So there wasn't those... But the moving of the Tower of London happened the same year that I left The Noise. And that wasn't a calculated thing. That just happened to happen like that.
Okay.
And then... So it wasn't... I mean, I still had... My life was still... My background was still very interesting, but not... It then became very interesting as soon as I left the Noise. So maybe it might not even, it just didn't cross my mind, I guess. I think also.
Yes, it's one of those wood for the trees things. Go on, sorry.
Yeah.
You said also.
I'd also think my dad was always very, very cautious about when he was still on his way to the top of the military of the family name and anything getting back on us. Like, I got arrested for drink driving when I was 18, and it made the newspaper because it was, you know, the son of top army officer, drink driving shame. And
yeah,
it's the worst I've ever felt in my entire life. And
yeah,
I remember telling my parents, then my dad went upstairs and my mum came down and went, "And if you want to know how much you've hurt this family, just go upstairs and listen to your father crying." I was like,
To be fair, yeah. Drink driving, that's not
awful.
An unreasonable.
Oh, no, and it's absolutely inexcusably awful. And then he came down, and my dad, I remember, he had tears in his eyes, and he hugged me, and he went, "Please, please don't turn into this boy you're turning into." Like, not angry, so like a pleading. And this from like an army officer, the head of the military, doing this, and that really broke me. And a lot of it was also because him and my mum had worked so hard to be exemplary and to try and get to this thing, and then I was drinking and driving. It was just so pathetically bad. So I think then I was then sort of hit with this, I don't want to ever bring shame on my family, so I hid a lot of it, I think. And then
if no one ever finds out about the show, then I'll be fine.
Yeah, exactly. So, but then, I think because when I left The Noise, my dad had moved to the Tower of London, and I was moving up. I was living in Brighton, but I was moving up to London, and I had the choice of either, you know, renting a shoebox in Zone 7 for £1 million, or living with my dad in the Great Historical Palace. And it was like, I'm definitely doing that. And then when you look, I couldn't live in the Tower of London and not mention it. I was doing my, I also, because I left The Noise and I had 8 months to put my first Edinburgh Fringe show together. And I hadn't got any material. I just had stagecraft. But I'd never, because I think you said before at the start, I knew loads of people. So I wasn't looked at as a new act, but I actually pretty much was.
Yes, but then also, it's not like you'd been in a band. You were an improv guy. You'd been making people laugh for a living for a long time.
And also, I had done I got a 2-2 at Kent University in the master's degree in stand-up, which...
Did you really?
I did, yes, with Pappies and Jimmy McGee and Laura Lex.
Oh, my God!
They're all alumni
Yes, but not that year. I mean, because I know Jimmy and Matt Crosby were the same...
Yes, Jimmy's older than me. Jimmy always calls me, I'm like, he's like my big brother. He always calls me the iPhone to his Nokia 3210. I'm the upgrade of Jimmy, is what Jimmy's words, not mine.
Gotcha.
Because okay. Jimmy, amazing comedian, and I looked up to him a lot. You know, dad was in the military, boarding school from six, went to Kent University, became a comedian, like the same.
Yeah, gotcha.
And okay. Look at me and Jimmy. We are cut from the same cloth.
I think that's fair, with all due respect to you both. So 8 months to write that new, well, let's just go back a bit. So Noise Next Door, that formed how, or what was your, how,
so
did your,
I then,
how did you connect?
I then went to University of Kent and I did a drama degree because I wanted to be an actor. just because I didn't realize stand-up comedy was an option or a thing. And then as I was doing more and more plays and performances, I realized that every single role I was auditioning and going for was the comedy role, and they were the roles that I liked. And I then realized, hang on, it's not acting you like making people laugh. That's what you always do. And then it was Oliver Double, Dr. Oliver Double, who's written a few books. I'm sure he must have come up on this podcast at some point. He was doing the master's degree in stand-up. And so I went, I'm going to do that. And then while doing that degree, me and the four of the Noise Next Door boys formed the Noise Next Door. And we'd start, it was
from,
first,
from the MA.
Well, no, it actually started in our second year of uni. It was called Whose Line. And then I think by the end, it was called Play It By Ear.
Yeah.
And then there was about 12 of us in Play It By Ear. And I haven't said that in ages. Then the five of us basically had a secret meeting and went, look, us five have got something here. We should really go for this. And then we squirreled ourselves away in my house and did a brainstorming session for names of the band. Things like Tusk.
Absolutely plausible.
Yeah, Gag Reflex, but that was thought of as too sexual. Tiny Little Improv Turtle was genuinely on the cards at one point.
You horrific people.
And then the story that we peddled was that we were up so night getting so angry about the name that we were shouting so much that the neighbours just went, can you quieten down? There's this constant noise next door. And we went, oh, that's it. But
PR fluff, don't believe a word of it.
Didn't happen. Basically, I think, I won't say who it was, because one of us said, the Noise Next Door is quite a good name, isn't it? And then we all went, yeah, that is a good name. Okay, we'll do that. And then so we started. And we moved into a one house with us and one of our girlfriends, who was our producer. For our first Edinburgh. And we lived in Shoreham-by-Sea by the Rope Tackle Theatre, which I'm sure you played at before as well. We started a residency in Brighton, in Hove. And because two of the guys went to Brighton College, so they had some contacts there. We went straight up to Edinburgh from uni. C Venues, which was a thing. Did that for 2 years. Then in our second year of doing that, we were then picked up by Ian Franklin, who runs the comedy club. And Rudy Liquid had come into C Venues and were watching a showcase. And it was Rudy Liquid who went, these guys are great. You should sign them, Ian.
Hey, there we go.
Yeah. And so thank you, Rudy. And so we did. And then we were with Ian Franklin for a bit. And then that got to its natural, as far as it did. Christian Knowles came a knocking with CKP. Then we did that. And then that was when, after 10 years, I then went, look, guys, I want to go and do it on my own.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you?
Tough.
Yes. Is it amicable enough with them now that you can talk to me about it being tough? Or is it better for us not to...
No, that's fine. It's amicable apart from one of us who is now doing his thing on his own. And I don't think anyone talks to him. He was a difficult character in the end. But the other ones, absolutely lovely. I still gig with them occasionally.
That's good. Do they ever let you back in for turn up and do a cameo sort of thing?
I've had a few times I've gone, right, Tom, we've got this corporate, but only two of us can make it. Can you come and do it? We'll give you we'll give you your whatever the money. I was like, it's on a Monday. Yeah. Yes, I can.
And yes, I'm there lovely.
Brushing off the skateboard, trying to do an Ollie. And then I've also, they still do the Noise Next Door's lock-in, which I think you've been a guest on. Sure. I'm quite often, I've been a guest on that a few times as well. And it's interesting. So I left, and then another one left, then another one left. So the one after me went back in, and then they got a new one as well. It became very Sugar Babes by the end, just a rotating cast of different people. But no, I love the boys, and they're still going very strong. And the thing about the Noise Next Door and going into comedy, so what I learned from Tony Allen, who does the alternative comedy, he wrote a book called Attitude.
Attitude.
Yeah.
And you want to make something of it.
Yeah, that's it.
Great.
And basically, the idea that you come up being for it's either it's writing and discipline and performance, and most people are either a performer naturally who needs to learn to write, or a writer naturally who needs to learn to perform. The noise next door meant I was a performer who needed to learn to write. I would argue that's the easier way around, but because I think lots of my early jokes were, I just do big gestures, and you know, lots of, like, before I was the posh comedian, I was very like, people think I'm gay, but I'm actually not. How weird's that? And it was all, which was just an excuse for me to be camp around the stage, because that's an easy laugh.
Fair enough.
So that's an easy laugh. So I had to then learn to write. And Tom Stade was the guy who then said to me, you know Tom, because everyone's got a Tom Stade impression, haven't they? But he challenged me. He said, if you want to know if a joke works, do your whole set. Don't take the microphone out the stand. And so I tried then to just go there and just do my routines just with the mic in the stand, just to see if that would work. If the material stood up on its own, then
did
the...
It?
No, not at all. terrible. Absolutely awful. My Cats the Musical routine got binned pretty quickly. then the other big leap in my development as far as writing is actually... because I was tour support for Milton Jones for 3 years.
Yes.
We ended up doing over 200 gigs together. And because it's his show, he works clean. So he said, you've got to do a clean 25. So I had to rewrite all my stuff, taking out all the swearing. And when you do that, you actually realize how often you do just use F-bombs and C-bombs as punchlines. And you then also, because you have to think of different punchlines and endings, you come up with much more interesting stuff to say, and the flavors of your sets become just much more much deeper. So I also credit Milton with also pushing me another level in writing as well.
Yes, that, and he James Acaster used to be Milton's tour support for a long time.
So James Acaster,
I think it was very,
and Nish Kumar.
Yes,
in fact, he said, yeah, Milton very much said, look, it's sort of the golden goose, this. If you're my tour support, if you don't make something of it, it's your fault. Like, because look.
lovely Milton. So, and brilliant. What a pedigree. Like, to kind of, to almost kind of study under Milton. And like, you go out and do as well as you do, and then he goes out and is Milton Jones.
Yeah. Most sort of English degree people, when they say you studied Milton, it's different. But that I really did study Milton. Because also, actually, I think what was very good as well with that is, I think after the Noise Next Door, because I felt very trapped in the Noise Next Door. They had, because it was a 5 people and we had some quite strict rules and we had to share hotel rooms. We were all traveling. They had girlfriends. I didn't. So I felt very enclosed, sort of I couldn't be my full self with my family as well, because I couldn't speak.
Had you created another boarding school for yourself, Tom?
I had.
Oh, mate.
Exactly that. And so when I left,
I live in a house with a bunch of men and don't have a girlfriend and there are strict rules. Oh, Tom.
Yes. when I then left them, it was the first time I remember, like, that I felt properly like, oh my God, I'm free. Like, and I realized that I had been boarding school all my life. I had been army barracks all my life. I had been in the Noise Next Door my whole life. And then now it's suddenly, Tom, you're an individual. And I started having panic attacks. I started freaking out. It I really went from a bad, who the hell am I? Started doing a lot of
because
drugs, a lot of alcohol.
You were institutionalized.
Yeah. And so
I
went off the rails, and I'd be rocking up to gigs early on, just sweating because I'd been up doing, God knows what into the early hours. Then I still managed to do reasonably well because I had contacts already, and I think I had a reasonably good natural ability as far as just stage persona. But it was then being on the Milton tour where the man likes to have a beer and a whiskey in a hotel room, but it's then discipline and being on the road with not a father figure, but a mentor. Absolutely. It's a teacher. And so he also then made me realize that if I actually wanted to go to the next level, you can't be treating yourself like that. You've got to have discipline. And so I also very much credit him for that. So I'm very grateful for him for that as well.
Was it painful to learn that lesson because you had been in disciplined situations all your life and suddenly were free? Like, what were the upshots of the upside of freedom? Presumably, I would sort of imagine, I suppose I was very surprised when you said, oh, I had panic attacks because I couldn't cope with it, because it sounds like when you say freedom, that sounds like such a positive sort of a thing. Was it?
Oh, but no, it's sort of like, you know, the end of Shawshank Redemption, where the old man gets free and then he hangs himself because he just doesn't know what to do with himself. Like, you know, freedom isn't always, you know, people go back to toxic relationships because it's the familiarity of it all. For example, just even if I was hungover at a Noise Next Door gig, I could rock up and four other people on the stage would see me through it, or someone else would drive the car. But I remember, like, I certainly remember one time driving to a gig in the middle of nowhere and then waking up steamingly hungover, then realizing I had another gig to go to and I had to drive, and all the drink driving stuff came back to me. And I went, I've stuck myself in this position because I wasn't disciplined enough just not to have a drink. And then when I eventually did get to the gig, I was sweating on stage, but I was the only one on stage and the spotlight was on me and I was stuttering the words and stuff. And there wasn't catchy song to sing. Hooray. Yeah. It was just like, no, we're all looking at you now. And then realizing, no, everything is now your responsibility. It's all on you now. And that was terrifying.
When you said earlier on that one of the things you had to do post comedy as a reaction to bullying was that you had to learn to become sincere. The Noise Next Door are fantastic and fun. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of room for sincerity.
There's
because
none.
It's an improv show.
Zero, absolutely, yeah. Zero. Or individuality, really, to an extent. We were coloured ties. You were Mr. Purple. You're Mr. Green. You're Mr. White.
Yes. So I still struggle with a lot of those guys' names.
So do I, to be honest.
But no more so than any other four-person plus group.
It's a lot.
You know.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. There wasn't room for individuality. But just coming back to this idea of sincerity, you had experience of laughing your way out of being bullied, or, you know, comedying your way out of being bullied. And you had experience of making a living, doing, you know, really fun, people on their feet, standing ovation shows, corporate gigs and what have you with the Noise Next Door, which is all out, out, big, think quickly, say the first thing. And so did you find that in your stand-up, in your solo stand-up, when there is nowhere to hide and also far more room in which to play, did you find, or do you find, that it is a sort of a continuing journey to remember to be sincere and to hold yourself back from all the tricks that you know inside out?
I think it's a very big leap in your progression on stage to understand the power of sincerity, and the power of silence is a huge thing. I think when you start out comedy, you're chasing the laugh and you're chasing the gag, but if a gag doesn't land, it's sometimes the more powerful thing to, rather than go, oh, did you not like that one? Oh, okay. To be able to just pause and hold a room in silence, which is sort of married to sincerity in a way, you know, but not having to be the dancing clown and understand that there's a power to that, I think. So I certainly, yeah, when I realized that, the best way to be funny is to not try and be constantly desperately funny all the time, to ride it out. Because then you get the deep soulful laughs and the bigger punchlines and the more insightful takes. I think humor can be a lot of things. I think it can be escapism. It can just be jokes, but a lot of what comedy actually is at its most powerful is revealing truth. And even just revealing a truth is funny in itself. And that's, you know, you can do that in a sincere way, and that's funny. I think I learned that, rather than trying to think of that's a funny gag or a bit of wordplay, trying to actually hold a mirror up onto yourself and find something real, I think, is important.
Are you happy, Tom?
I'm content. And I like content. I think it's better than having it. Happiness is fleeting. Contentment suggests a longevity and an understanding that life goes up and down. And I feel I am now at a situation where I feel secure in myself, in where I am. I've overcome a lot since the noise and since childhood. I'm feeling very content.
And have you forgiven your parents for boarding school?
Never. No.
So that was Tom Horton. Thank you so much to Tom for coming on the show. A joy to finally get him on. He's so much fun to watch. He really, really lights up a room, and on stage and off stage as well. Very, very pleasant presence off stage, and an all round good egg. And God, it sounds like, I mean, I some of that boarding school stuff gave me flashbacks to a life I didn't lead. Do you know what I mean? Just harrowing. And I'm very glad that he's now chosen to make the comedy industry his boarding school or something, or whatever cod psychology I attempted at the time. I seem to remember one of them felt like a coup, and there's another one of them on the Insiders Club extra material, at which point I think he said, how long have you had that stored up? And I felt bad. But no, so loads more stuff to find on the feed, comedianscomedian.com/insiders, to know about that. Oh, it feels good to be back in the saddle doing these. I'll do the thank yous and then I'll explain what we're doing. So thank you once again. You can follow, you go to honourabletom.com, honourable with a U, of course, and you can find a link there to his tour. He's all over the place. Extra dates are being added as we speak. In fact, I left it up in front of me where he's sold out Reading, Maidenhead, Bromley, Guildford. Why am I telling you the sold out places? He's added dates, extra dates in London. He's doing Leicester Square Theatre, good lad. Southampton, Hemel, Chorley, Hexham, Salford, Reading, Maidstone, Crawley, Darleydale, Measham, Droitwich. No, I've added those three from the old DFS sofa advert. But Maidenhead, Colchester, Guildford and Bath, those are just the ones that have been added in June. He's still cracking on throughout March and April, so loads of Tom to get there. So that's that. Thank you, Tom. Thank you to Moz for logging. Thank you to producer Nathan for sorting out almost everything else. The music was by Rob Smouten, and I am and remain Stuart Goldsmith. I'm going to amble at you. I'll post amble at you after this noise made by a horse. Cheerio. Nice to be back, isn't it? It's nice. I've got so much to post amble at you at, but let's find out. I've got 7 minutes till my tea's ready. So let's try and do it in seven. First things first, previews have been going great guns. I'm spinning plates, man. Oh my God. I've got like, what are the projects? There's Project X. It's a book. That is coming along nicely. Thank you once again to fabulous Susie, who is helping me with some of the administrative hellscape required when trying to catch bits of insights from 420 odd episodes. So that's working well. We've got a good system and we're cracking on. So Project X is going well. Still not officially released, but there it is. Officially, you know, sanctioned to talk about in public. But there it is. And also the Eco Show, the show. Listen, what I've been telling people is the Edinburgh Fringe Show this year. It's called Spoilers. That's for definite. I don't think I don't know if I'm contracted yet, but I'm pretty sure it's going to be a Monkey Barrel in the mid-afternoon. I can't wait for that. I've been saying to people it's kind of earnest, heart on my sleeve, climate crisis stuff. But I realised it's not climate crisis stuff. It's climate anxiety stuff, and more specifically, climate resilience stuff. I'm talking about the well in my mind that I fall down whenever I remember that the climate crisis exists. And maybe you do as well. And so the bones of the show at this stage in development are about kind of isolating, recognising and making fun of all of the things that kick me down the well. And perhaps they do that to you as well. And then coming up with ways to climb back out of the well. So I think it's going to be as optimistic. I mean, I'm doing actual research. I spoke to a guy today in the States, I won't give you any information about him because I haven't checked if I can, but he is a director of sustainability at a massive organization, and he's kind of chipper. It's qualified upbeatness, and the ways in which it are qualified are themselves, now I think of it, quite sort of depressing. But the point is, I'm tackling it, and I'm really enjoying tackling it, and it's, I don't think anyone is coming out in tears. I think I've got this weird, should I go into detail on this? No. In brief, one of the challenges is I don't want people who come and see my climate comedy show, which is vaguely educational but 99% funny. And it's important to me that the vaguely educational bits are also funny. So let's say it's 100% funny. But it's important to me that people aren't frightened. But I don't want people to be frightened because they're complacent and they haven't done the reading and they don't realise what dire straits we're in. So what it means is that at the moment, at least, in order to make people feel happy and positive, I first need to tell some portions of the audience just how bad things are, so that then I can try and make them feel inspired and active and hopeful. And part of me is wondering whether I shouldn't just leave people be to eke out the rest of their days in, what's the word, in pig ignorance. Not pig ignorance. What I mean is, if you don't realize how bad it is, and this is a wider question than my show, if you don't realise how much trouble we're in, is it a good idea to tell people how much trouble they're in and we're all in and burst their bubble in order that they try and activate a bit? Yes, I think it is a good idea, and I think I'm going to have to keep doing that. This wasn't supposed to be the postamble at all. I was going to tell you all about ADHD. So many lovely little ironies along the way. My favourite thing that happened in my obviously positive ADHD diagnosis was that at one point I was talking about how Rory Bremner describes ADHD as a superpower and how that's fair enough and positive and all the rest of it. But also I do take issue with that slightly in that. No, I don't take issue with it. It's just that sometimes it doesn't feel it even talking about it like it, like it's this thing I've taken. I mean, you know, there we go. Got a doctor's note and everything. I've got it. But also, it's me. I've got me. It's just, oh, Shappy, bless. I bumped into Shaparak Kosandi, and she said, we agreed that there's a certain ickiness to the kind of welcome to the community stuff that people do in a very well-meant way. She said, it's just like being left-handed. It is. It's just like being left-handed. So to talk about it like it's this big thing feels inherently weird. I'm not used to that yet. But I talked about the Rory Bremner superhero thing and about how I don't necessarily feel like it's a superpower. In fact, it would be nicer not to be. I mean, you know, I'm curious about taking medication for it just to see what I would be like were I not so easily distracted. But don't worry, if I've got a post-amble recording coming up, I'll swerve the meds. Anyway, during the assessment, I was talking about that. And when I said Rory Bremner, a cat walked in the window of my doctor's Zoom meeting. Walked in through the window behind her, and I said, oh, there's your cat. And then I was like, oh my God, is this part of the test? Have you primed your cat that if anyone as soon as someone mentions Rory Bremner, the cat sneaks in and you clock exactly how fast I get distracted? I mean, honestly, it's one of those things where, it has this weird kind of, I'll talk more about this another time. It has this weird resonance whereby, oh, I'm on a minute left till tea time. Wrapping up, it has this weird resonance whereby it's kind of rippling throughout the rest of my life, where things I've taken for granted, behaviours of mine that I've taken for granted, I'm now suddenly looking at through the prism of, oh, I've got a particular shaped brain. I mean, what, 5% of people have got it? So there's 20 brain shapes. I mean, it's not about shape, but it's an analogy, right? Shut up, it's an analogy. If sort of there are 20 shapes of brain, say, and one in 20, one of the brain shapes is this one. If that's all it is, it's just rippling throughout, like, oh God, suddenly I'm looking at years worth of postambles and going, oh, is the way I talk to you when I'm on my own and I'm chatting that I hope you find. I mean, God, I've got no data on whether or not this has made people leave in droves. I've got a small amount of data on some people that like this and get in touch with me. But how much of this is ADHD related? Arguably, it doesn't matter. It's just what I do. But that's the first time I've thought about it. If I start using the medication, pingers they are. It's not like SSRIs. It's not like, you know, whatever those kind of like endorphin or moods. I don't even know the language. It's not like those whereby you need to build up to a thing and then if you go cold turkey, that's dangerous. They're just like, as I understand it, they're just like take one a day and get more shit done and beat yourself up less. If I do that, is that going to affect the way these happen? Is there going to be some weird Fry on Futurama 300th coffee hummingbird moment? You get that reference or you don't. Where, a week or two or three from now, I do a postamble and it's ordered and insightful and doesn't ping like a fucking pinball machine. And you just hear in the background a sort of a thin hum, like a whine, like, because I've achieved exactly the right amount of medication. And do you want that? And do I want that? And that's tea time. I'm going to go and have my tea. Is it a personality or is it just a load of coping strategies roped together? Bye for now.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.